Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Iva Glishich, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Lisa Kirschenbaum about her new book, Soviet Adventures in the Land of the Capitalists, Ilf and Petrov's American Road Trip. Lisa is professor of history at Westchester University. Her research focuses on this link between individual private lives and big momentous events in Russian 20th century history. She's published three books before Soviet Adventures that we'll talk about today. Small Comrades, Revolutionizing Childhood in Soviet Russia between 1917 and 1932. The Legacy of the Siege of Leningrad from 1914 to 1995, Myth, Memories, and Monuments. And International Communism in the Spanish Civil War, Solidarity and Suspicion, published in 2015. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Now, I wonder if you could begin by telling us just a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I've been at Westchester a long time. And as you listed the topics that I've worked on, they sound pretty disparate, I guess, from the Siege of Leningrad to small children to volunteers in the Spanish Civil War. But the thread that I'm really interested in, as you mentioned, is the ways in which kind of individual people have navigated the big, often traumatic events of the 20th century. I got interested in this particular project after working on the Spanish Civil War project, and I kept running across a lot of return migrants, people, especially Jews, who had emigrated from the Russian Empire to the United States, and then in the 1930s decided that it was time to go home. And I put that kind of in quotation marks because they had never been to the Soviet Union. And in some cases lived in parts of the former empire that were parts of different states during the interwar period. Some of that draw was obviously the depression in the United States, but some of it clearly was a kind of ideological commitment to the Soviet project. So I got really interested in what's going on in these immigrant communities in the United States that people are still in the early 1930s feeling so attached to the Soviet Union as their homeland. And that's what got me thinking about Ilf and Petrov's road trip as a way to locate those immigrant communities in the United States. So it's in some ways a real departure from earlier things that I've done. And it's certainly a lot more fun, I think, than anything I've done. I was, after having worked on things like the Siege of Leningrad, it's really a pleasure work on a really funny guys road trip in the United States. But there are kind of linkages, I think, too, which have been really interesting for me to explore.
It's really interesting where your research can take you and what are some of the threads that kind of appear over the course of researching a topic, isn't it? Now, as we mentioned, your book traces a journey across the U.S. taken by Ilya Ilf and Yevgeny Petrov. These are the two Soviet satirical authors who were active during the 1920s and 1930s and the Soviet Union. So can you tell us a little bit about these two Soviet funny men, as you refer to them?
They really are funny. They were already famous when they came to the United States in 1935. They're most famous for two books that I think still hold up, actually, when you read them. The 12 Chairs, which was published in 1928, and The Little Golden Calf, which was published in 1931. By 1935, both of those books were very popular in the Soviet Union. They had also been published in English translation in the United States. And so they were well-known figures in the United States when they arrived. They worked as a team, which I think is really interesting. They had their technique was really to sit down and kind of write each sentence together. They didn't write all of their American travelogue that way because Ilf was quite sick by the time they were writing it. So they really were a kind of a comedic team. And they were also really masters of the literary road trip. Both of those novels are really road trip novels or picaresques.
That's right.
They send the sort of charming con man, Ostap Bender, across the Soviet Union from, you know, the Black Sea to Siberia. He's kind of a marvelous figure. He's more sort of amoral outsider than outright villain. He's sort of a con man who prides himself on never breaking the letter of the law. And so they had explored this kind of literary road trip in both of those novels. And then what's really interesting, of course, in their American travelogue is that they become the kind of collective narrator of their own road trip. They're not quite as amoral as Bender, but of course they're more outsiders because they're turning, by this time, their satirical gaze on a much safer target, not the Soviet Union anymore, which is the object of their satire in the two Bender novels, but instead on the US, where they could have a lot more freedom, obviously, to criticize and to find flaws than they could have by 1935 in the Soviet Union.
But you note in your book that they are constantly reflecting in a way in comparison. I mean, that's a constant reference point, whether it's explicit or implicit. But,
exactly. Yeah. And I think that's a really important part of what I wanted to get across is that they know that their Soviet readers can fill in the missing comparisons. Yeah. So when they give their account of a gas station in the United States, which an American might read as whatever, that's like a normal gas station, doesn't seem that exciting. Why are you so, you know, wild-eyed about this thing? But if you then read an account of what it's like just to fill up your tank in the Soviet Union, it's like, okay, now I get it. Why? So they don't have to fill in, right? They don't have to be explicit about those comparisons.
Yeah, that's right. So a reader is quite well trained at that point in reading in between and outside the text. Yeah. And I absolutely love your description of their writing process. That was so cooperative, I mean, literally sitting and you think about the difficulty of co-authoring anything, and this is pretty remarkable, the process, and they clicked.
And they have a very funny kind of autobiographical piece where they talk about themselves as sort of a single entity, one part of which was born, you know, in 1 year, and then the other part of which was born later on.
A bit later, but, yeah.
You know, but it is a really interesting process, and they write that if they both came up with the same word, then they knew it was bad, right? And then they had to try something else. It was too obvious or something.
Too obvious.
but they seem like a really good comic team. Yeah. Ilf, I think, was the more kind of sardonic and of the two, and Petrov was the little bit, I think, sunnier kind of personality.
Right. well, let's talk about the project and the research process. Tell us about your sources and your method. You were quite immersed in this project in a very interesting way.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was really, in some ways it's, I mean, you hear this cliche all the time that doing history is like a detective novel, but I really felt like I was following clues in this project. I knew from their published work that they had relied on lots of Americans. Neither one spoke English very well. They didn't know how to drive. They really depended on Americans to help them with their trip. And I knew that some of those Americans were immigrants, and their notes and letters provided a lot of clues then that I could follow to figure out who these people were. And of course, because they're famous authors, I'm not used to writing about famous authors, because they're famous authors, those letters and Ilse notebooks are actually published. So I had fairly easy access to all of those clues. And that's what I used to try and track down a lot of the people that they interacted with. But kind of every story in the travelogue, which of course is very episodic, was a very discrete kind of research problem. So in some cases, I could use government records. They only mention in passing the process of getting American visas, but I went to the National Archives in College Park and, you know, did a lot of work in the Visa Division archives. U.S. didn't, unlike the Soviet Union at the time, the U.S. really did nothing to track Soviet visitors once they were in the U.S., but they did have to get clearance. You know, they had to get a visa to come. So that was sort of the point of contact. And I found their, for example, their visa interviews, which interestingly, they both lie in. They say, oh, no, we don't know anyone in the U.S., which was clearly not true because they had an American translator, an American publisher. And Ilf says, I don't have any family in the US, which is completely untrue because all of his father's siblings and his parents too emigrated to the US at the turn of the 20th century and lived in Hartford, Connecticut.
That's right. They even visit him during the trip.
They even visit them, right? He realizes, maybe I don't want to tell the US government this, maybe I don't want to tell the Soviet government this, but doesn't dissuade them from visiting. So some of it is government records. Some of the key contacts had FBI files, which provided another kind of interesting perspective. The people who were very famous, people like Ruben Mamoulian, who was the director of Porgy and Bess on Broadway in 1935, and also directed the first Technicolor feature in 1935, Becky Sharp, was an immigrant from the Soviet Union. He had immigrated from Soviet Armenia in the 1920s, but he has a huge personal archive. So that includes lots of direct traces of Ilf and Petrov's visit. Like he had an autograph book that he had people sign for him. And sure enough, they have a page in his autograph book, and he shows up on their calendar. And I found the letter of introduction that Sergei Eisenstein wrote for Ilf and Petrov. So in some cases like that, I found lots of direct evidence. In other cases, like the film director Louis Milestone, or Lev Milstein, he also is an immigrant from the Russian Empire, I didn't find any direct evidence of their visit, but I found lots of information about his trips to Russia and his interest in Russian-themed movies. So I was able to kind of build a context for that. The toughest thing really was to find like the ordinary people who they interact with. They pick up hitchhikers along the way. They're interested in knowing about kind of ordinary Americans. In one case, one of those hitchhikers actually was had a profile of him in the newspaper at the time. So I was able to find that. But in other cases, I had a sort of get a general sense of the immigrant communities that they were dealing with, local oral history projects, and especially this unbelievable project that the anthropologist Paul Rodden had supervised in the Bay Area in 1935-36. He too, of course, was a Russian immigrant for the WPA, where they did a massive kind of life history survey of the Bay Area's foreign-born population. So I couldn't find maybe the exact immigrants that Ilf and Petrov had contacted, but I was able to find similarly situated people who gave interviews at almost exactly the same moment to this research project. So there, for every incident, I had to think, you know, how can I get at these people a little bit? And then, of course, there's also a lot of published, there were published interviews. I used, they have a, they present their trip in the form of a photo essay as well as a travelogue. So I looked at American photo essays that covered essentially the same ground at roughly the same time. Again, not with the idea of deciding, you know, were they right? Were they accurate? Were they lying? So much as trying to get a sense of their specifically Soviet perspective, right? How did they see the situation versus how people on the American side maybe saw the same situation? So it was less about kind of trying to verify them, although obviously there's a part of that that's going on, but really more about this whole process of how did each side try to understand the other side, the sort of bigger question of cross-cultural understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's such interesting selection of sources, the different threads, but you also did the trip yourself, is that right?
I did a good bit of it myself. And my idea was, and I didn't do it like they did though, in one shot. I had to teach and do other things in between, but I did segments of it. And it was really fun and very illuminating to do because, as I said, Ilf took pictures. So I was able to almost literally stand in his shoes, right? Looking at the landscape or the cityscape from almost essentially the same spot where he was standing when he snapped his picture. And so that helped me kind of get a sense of what really caught his eye. You know, what is he cropping out of his picture? Where is he directing his camera? And so that was really, really useful. I sort of recount briefly in the book that he has this on the front page of the travelogue. There's this picture of the Empire State Building that you can see almost the entire facade of the Empire State Building. And the photographer, Alexander Rodchenko, when he reviewed their photographs, said, oh, this is just like the most sort of like...
he was not just, excited, you know, about it.
He wasn't. He thought it was, you know, like, all right, whatever. If you're on the street and you look up, that's the view of the skyscraper that you see. I argue that it's actually funnier than that because there's a very elaborate caption that goes with it. But I also went, you know, to New York City. I'm like, where did they shoot this from? And it turns out it's actually kind of hard to find a vantage point on Fifth Avenue where you can see the entire facade of the Empire State Building. Usually it's blocked by other buildings. So I was like, you know, this is actually more difficult than you would think to find where to take that particular shot.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And yeah, we'll talk a little bit about their photographs, but that exchange with Dorchenko is also really insightful about the thinking about photography at this point in time in the Soviet Union. I also love the moment when you described that you were dining at the same diner where they would have eaten and probably the food has not changed that much from.
Well, I don't know that it was the same. I don't know if it was the same place, but I had the enchiladas in Santa Fe, and they described them as sort of appetizing blintzes cut with gunpowder and topped with nitroglycerin. And the very first day that I was in Santa Fe, I'm like, well, we got to go get enchiladas.
Exactly.
And they were among the spiciest things. I like spicy food, and they were among the spiciest things that I've ever eaten. And it was very funny because in the restaurant, they had a little box in the corner that was labeled gunpowder. They made the same joke, right? I felt like I ate as they did. And the other place where I really felt like I was kind of walking in their steps most clearly was in San Francisco. The library where I worked on this oral history project material is essentially the neighborhood that they would have visited. And it's still a neighborhood where you can see so clearly the absolute extremes of poverty, even more extreme, I think, than in the 1930s, the absolute extremes of wealth and poverty in the city of San Francisco. And so that also felt like a moment when I really kind of understood what they were seeing.
Yeah. This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Yeah, this is something that comes through their account of the U.S., these big disparities and other topics that we'll talk about. The trip takes place in the late 1935 and early 1936. This is a 10,000-mile road trip from New York and back. And their adventure unfolds against the background of these tense relationships between the Soviet Union and United States. Tell us about the motivation for this trip. What challenges did they face in organizing their travels? And why did they decide to undertake this road trip at this point?
It's a really interesting moment that they come in 1935. It's in some ways an incredibly hopeful moment. The U.S. and the Soviet Union had only normalized relations in 1933. And in 1935, it's still a new thing. And so clearly they're being sent as kind of cultural ambassadors. And it's interesting that the choice is not a political figure or anybody with any kind of sort of radical kind of background, but this idea of having friendly relations by sending these two funny men, right, to the United States, people who are not really political figures, but very clearly cultural figures. The U.S. and the Soviet Union had, even before they normalized relations, had a lot of trade relations. Obviously, in the 1930s, with the U.S. in the Depression, the attractiveness of Soviet markets becomes more important for American business people. The Soviets, whose economy is booming, are undertaking an industrialization drive, are very interested in U.S. expertise and U.S. materials to drive that industrialization. So they have economic motives for doing it. They have some political motives. Everybody's a little worried about Japanese aggression. And so there's this hopefulness that maybe, the U.S. and the Soviet Union could kind of be friends, right? There's a certain kind of, shared interests there, both economic and political. But the good feeling only went so far. And a key obstacle from the U.S. side was always this kind of concern that the Soviet Union was committed to a violent overthrow of the U.S. government, which is maybe technically speaking, right, kind of true. The Soviets are backing the idea of world revolution through the Comintern. They actually haven't been very successful trying to do any of that. There's a lot of hysteria on the U.S. side about the dangers of communist propaganda. I think this is why Ilf is hesitant to say either to the Soviet or the American authorities that he has family in the United States, friendly, but not too friendly. And really, just before they come in the summer of 1935, there's this kind of very confrontational moment in which the U.S. is threatening to break relations over the presence of American communists at the Comintern Congress in the summer of 1935. That ends up not happening, but maybe is all the reason, right, to send some funny men over to kind of smooth things out. So they're coming at this moment when friendly relations seem possible, at the moment of the Popular Front, when there is this interest on the Soviet side in maybe setting aside, maybe just temporarily, some of the more revolutionary rhetoric in the interest of creating a kind of popular front against fascism. So that's the kind of moment that they come in. It's a really hopeful moment in a lot of ways. They start planning this 10,000-mile road trip. They claim in the travelogue when they're on the boat over, and that may be true. Initially, they're thinking of something a little bit less sort of grandiose, but they very quickly get this idea of this massive, to Hollywood and back kind of road trip. part of the motivation for that is their idea that they want to show Soviet people the real America, the America beyond the skyscrapers of New York City. That's why they call the book One Story America in
It's a really interesting title. It's not very clear immediately where the title comes from, but it's
a really kind of awful title in English, because you don't know if it's like a single story, like a single narrative or a single story.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. It's like low rise America, right? Like the low rise buildings outside of the big industrial cities where sort of real America, as they call it, is. So they want to see that sort of America beyond New York City. I also have a strong sense that they have a desire to go to Hollywood because they're interested, and they don't write about this in the published work at all, but they're interested in selling a screenplay. So they know that Boris Pilniak, when he went to the US in the early 1930s, he did work briefly in Hollywood as a screenwriter. And I think they have the idea that maybe we could, you know, maybe we could sell something in Hollywood too. So that's part of their motivation, I think, for getting to the West Coast, and especially getting to Hollywood, which they think of as different than Los Angeles, which I find is really funny. someone who lived in Los Angeles for a long time, Hollywood and Los Angeles, two totally separate places for them. And in logistical terms, as I said, it was hard because they didn't really speak English. I think they took some, I mean, they knew some English before they came. I think they took some English like lessons when they were in New York, but their English was, as they described it, not too remarkable. So they needed someone who could translate. They needed someone who could drive. They couldn't drive. And they needed someone who could sort of show them around. So they had to find this sort of angel without wings, right? Who was willing to do all those things and willing to do it basically for nothing because they didn't have anything to pay them with. So eventually they, and I describe in the book kind of this whole like different candidates, but they end up settling on what seems like sort of the ideal tour guide in a lot of ways for them, Solomon Trone and his wife, Florence. Trone was an immigrant, a Jewish immigrant from the Russian Empire, who had worked as an engineer for GE, spent a lot of time in the Soviet Union working on industrial projects for General Electric. His wife was the daughter of immigrants from the Russian Empire. She spoke Russian. And she did the driving. She was apparently a superb driver. So they got sort of the whole package, and they did it for free. They didn't, you know, so they didn't pay them as apparently as guides or drivers. So that was the sort of technical detail that they had to figure out before they could go.
Yeah. Once they arrive to the US, they're in New York. And right. They spend quite a bit of time actually in New York before the road trip starts. What do they do there?
And which is interesting, right? Because they say, oh, we want to find the America
the
beyond
real America.
New York. But they spend a month in New York City and they love it, as far as I can tell. They criticize it, but they really, I think, really do love it. A lot of what they're doing there is work. They have literary business to attend to in New York City. They meet with their American publisher, who gives them an advance, actually, on the travelogue. They knew from the get-go that it was going to be published more or less simultaneously in English translation in the United States, and obviously in Russian in the Soviet Union. They met with their American translator, who they call Fat Charles. It's not very nice. They don't seem to like him very much. They tried to get an American Russian language American newspaper that had published the 12 chairs without their permission and without paying them to pay them some royalties. They did a lot of interviews with the Russian language press. They did an interview with the New Yorker. So they're doing a lot of kind of literary business. They don't write a lot about that in the public travelogue, but clearly there's work to be done in New York City. They make lots and lots of connections with American cultural figures and also with a lot of Russian immigrant cultural figures. There's a big reception for them at the consul in New York, which they have a very funny description of
That's right.
in the travelogue, it becomes in part the inspiration for Satan's Ball in Bulgakov's Master and Margarita. And they did a lot of, you know, sort of cultural things. They went to museums, they went to concerts. Petrov's brother, Valentin Kataev, had a play on Broadway, Squaring the Circle. They went to see that. They went to see other Broadway plays. They went to see Porgy and Bess at Ruben Rabelais' invitation. As I mentioned, they saw Ilf's cousins and uncles up in Hartford, the family that he allegedly did not have. And they did lots of other touristy things in New York. And this is often the focus of the travelogue piece of it. They went to a rodeo at Madison Square Garden, which they totally loved, a boxing match, a wrestling match, a nightclub with, you know, scantily clad chorus girls, a burlesque show with strippers. They watched a ton of movies, and they went to the auto show, the New York auto show, and of course they bought their car. So they were busy. They were very busy.
That's right. That sounds like very busy and also really loving it, the whole thing. The section about cocktail parties and how Americans are all about cocktail parties is just a pearl and definitely worth, very interesting insight into what the Soviet visitor, how they perceive this kind of event and this type of gathering in the US.
Yeah, and it's funny too, right? Because one of their favorite authors, apparently, John Dos Passos, a lot of his sort of New York swirls around cocktail parties too. So they were sort of alerted beforehand that they should pay attention to that. But their idea that, you know, you're constantly being invited to more and more cocktail parties, and they conclude it's just dangerous to spend a year in the United States.
That's right. Now they somehow they managed to leave New York at this point. I'm interested in their route across the US, some of the specific destinations they chose to visit, and how do they put together their trip in that way?
I think they rely a lot on Trone for sort of the specifics of where and how they should go. They're traveling in the fall and winter of 1935. So he's particularly worried about, at least that's how they portray him in the book, of kind of bad weather, and they have to avoid certain places at certain times. In some ways, their itinerary is very typical of Soviet visitors to the U.S., both famous writers and more ordinary people who come. They make a point, for example, of seeing all the highlights, kind of American technology. They go up to Schenectady, New York, to see GE headquarters, and of course go to the big Ford plant in Dearborn. They actually meet Henry Ford. So those kinds of sort of technological sites are ones that would have attracted lots of Soviet visitors, and they definitely go there. They're interested in the natural wonders. They do go to Niagara Falls, although they don't mention it in the published travelogue. They go to the Grand Canyon. My sense is one of the main things that they themselves were particularly interested in seeing was the desert Southwest, and more particularly cowboys and Indians. They really wanted like the real like Wild West of cowboys and Indians. And one of the installments of the photo essay is actually titled Indians. And the other one is titled The Desert, but it could just as easily be titled Cowboys, because the only pictures of human beings in that segment are actually cowboys. So that I think is an important thing for them. But really, they were incredibly curious and just seemed interested in everything. They wanted to go to diners and cafeterias. They're interested in everything to do with the American road and the American highway, from gas stations to guest houses to they're fascinated by advertisements and sort of the American business of publicity. They, as I said, pick up hitchhikers along the way because they want to meet ordinary Americans. They're interested in the lives of Native Americans, both, I think, as sort of these romanticized Indians of their childhood reading, but also interested in this sort of problem of national minorities in the United States. They're interested in the lives of African Americans. So a lot of the photo essay, I think, gives you a sense of this. There's a segment of it that's called Negroes. There's a segment of it that's Indians. And then there's another segment of it that's called Americans. And that separation is itself really interesting, that somehow African Americans and Native Americans are for them not exactly Americans. It's an interesting kind of separation that they make. But they are everything that they can see in America, they want to see. There, and it's amazing where they go. They get invited to go up on the San Francisco Oakland Bay Bridge, which is then under construction. It's just unbelievable, like all of the varieties of experiences and people that they meet.
I mean, it's I guess because of their celebrity status, in a way, they had access to some incredible opportunities during this trip, as well as visiting gas pumps and divers. So it's a really incredible range.
Exactly. They have access to the kind of, you know, cultural and political elite. They actually meet, although I don't think they're introduced to him, the president of the United States, right? They go, they're reporters for Pravda, they actually go to an Oval Office press conference. I don't think they're actually introduced to Franklin Roosevelt, but they do, in a sense, meet the president. Yeah. They meet lots of, you know, famous cultural figures. And every place that they go, the kind of local Friends of the Soviet Union organizations organize receptions and outings and things for them to do.
It is that the readers will, I think, really enjoy this variety of experiences that they have. You describe a terrific episode in the White House when someone knocks at the doors of the Oval Office. Is that right? Which is, they cannot imagine the equivalent in the United States. The Soviet Union taking place.
They're just amazed by this sort of casual attitude toward meeting the president. I mean, and, you know, no, you can't imagine anybody sort of joking around with Stalin and saying, like, you're running 20 minutes late for the interview. But that's what the American reporters do, and they're just blown away by it.
That's right. and so the reader, I think, having that comparison is just really incredible insight into this period and the relationship between countries, the two countries. Tell us about the people. They meet lots of characters, as you note in your book. What are some of the highlights of their trip in that regard?
Just, as I said, they seem like they meet everyone. And as you said, because they're celebrities, a lot of the people that they meet are famous. One really important contact is the novelist John Dos Passos, who was very famous in the 30s, who I think Americans don't, I don't think anybody really reads him anymore. I don't know. But at the time that they came to the United States, there was actually a huge literary debate going on in the Soviet Union about whether or not Dos Passos's approach to fiction was one that could be a kind of model for socialist realism. Remember, no one really is exactly at this
what
moment
it is.
What socialist realism, what is it? You know, what's it supposed to do? So they meet Dos Passos. Dos Passos introduces them to the arguably more famous figure of Ernest Hemingway. So they meet Hemingway. They run into Paul Robeson at like a nightclub up in Harlem. In Carmel, they meet the famous muckraking journalist Lincoln Steffens and Albert Rhys Williams, who was famous for, along with John Reed, right, covering revolutionary Petrograd in 1917. They meet, as I said, Louis Milestone and Ruben Mamoulian are their big contacts in Hollywood, as well as some, again, immigrant actors who they meet. And they meet, of course, lots of less famous people too, especially immigrants from the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union. One of the, I think, very strange and interesting just sort of chance encounters is Alexandra Feshina, who is the former wife of the painter Nikolai Fechin, whose house in Taos, New Mexico is actually now the art museum in Taos, New Mexico. And they just they were up in Taos, you know, looking for places to meet Native Americans, and she happened to overhear them speaking Russian. And so she was like, wait, there are people speaking Russian here. And so she's kind of amazed, and they're equally, if not more, amazed to find, you know, a Russian lady in the middle of New Mexico. So that's a very unplanned kind of visit. More planned is they make a visit to the Mollokon community in San Francisco, which was a community of spiritual Christians who had been persecuted under the SARS. There was actually, I think, a bigger community in Los Angeles, but there was a pretty substantial community in San Francisco, which had arrived right around the time of the earthquake, actually, in 1906. And so they make a visit to that community in San Francisco. In Carmel, they also have, again, just this completely fortuitous and sort of strange coincidence that they run into this guy, Mr. Sharkey, who introduces himself as a former heavyweight boxer, who it turns out is like an undercover red hunter trying to find incriminating evidence on the all the radicals in Carmel, which they learn later on. Trone sends them a clipping from the newspaper saying, like, this is the guy we met in Carmel. And he was like, you know, this undercover detective looking to find that these radicals are taking money from the Soviet Union. As I mentioned, he meets the president. So just an incredibly wide range of people. They meet Henry Ford. Mm. I'm probably leaving out some of the more interesting.
I mean, the list is incredible. You note in your books, your book, diplomats, journalists, anthropologists, artists, poets, novelists, filmmakers, engineers, jokers, dock workers, revolutionaries, and a few scoundrels.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So it's quite a collection.
It's quite a collection. And from sort of that sort of high to low, right?
They
meet, you know, a communist organizer in Houston. They, you know, I would count Sharkey among the scoundrels, I think. They meet the poet Witter Bynner in Santa Fe, who, again, I think is not that well known anymore. Again, through a letter of introduction from Dos Passos. But Bynner, to me, is one of the great missed opportunities of the trip. He, in the early 20th century, right before World War I, he and a friend undertake this sort of literary hoax, and they cook up this fake school of modernism, and they publish all these poems, and and it's a total spoof, right? But it gets taken very seriously. He even agrees to write a review of his own literary hoax, you know, before they finally come clean. And so I think they would really have loved to hear some of this story, but I don't think they ever did. I don't think they learned much about him.
Yeah. No, they do have quite a number of encounters that are extraordinary.
Yeah, they meet the photographer Margaret Bourke White. I mean, everybody.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Really, that's right. Everyone who's everyone, and then a lot more than that. And a huge presence of really Russians and people in the Soviet Union that are present throughout this trip,
right,
in the US. Now, Ilf and Petrov wrote journals, notes, and letters during their trip. As you mentioned, they also were there as Pravda journalists. So they published a couple of articles back in the Soviet Union during that trip. How did their private impressions of their travels differ from the account that was ultimately published under the title One Story in America, in the Soviet Union, and then it's Little Golden America in the U.S.
Right, which is an unfortunate title.
you already noted that they don't mention they're going to Hollywood to pitch their script, but what are some of your impressions of these differences between?
In some ways, they're very close, mm-hmm. right? Like the published book and the published photo essay, in many cases, is very close to what they describe in the unpublished work. Like they go to some of the same places, they meet similar kinds of people, they do similar kinds of things. It's not it's not fictive, right? It really is based on those real experiences and often very closely connected to them. What they do, though, in the published work is they take an awful lot of liberties with the chronology. So sometimes they compress it, sometimes they pull it apart for, you know, literary effect to make a certain kind of point. And they are very loose with names and identifications. And that's the place where tracking down the people that they meet can be challenging because they don't always tell you. So they don't always identify their guides by name. So they really obscure the degree to which they're meeting with and relying on Russian Jewish immigrants. Like, so that the Trones, which is not to me is a very obviously Jewish last name anyway, but they give them the all-American last name, Mr. and Mrs. Adams, in the book. So that's a big change, right? That we're not being taken around by, he remains a GE engineer. They live almost at the exact same address. They have a two-year-old daughter. A lot of the facts are the same, but what you might say is a fundamental one, that they are not related to the Adamses, they're not sort of this white Anglo-Saxon Protestant elite, but are actually Jewish immigrants, naturalized citizen, right? In Solomon Trone's case, that gets left out. So there's a lot of those kinds of shifts. They mention, famous directors in Hollywood, but they don't mention that the two famous directors that they spent the most time with are Milestone and Mamoulian, both of whom had roots in the Russian Empire. So again, it's there. There's pictures of both Milestone and Mamoulian in the photo essay, but their immigrant backgrounds are completely obscured, right? We don't talk about that. Dos Passos is a really interesting case because he shows up in some of the early excerpts, one of the early excerpts that's published in the Soviet Union. But by 1937, when the novel comes out, the literary debate in the Soviet Union has been settled. He is considered not a good fit for Soviet literature. And so he gets excised. He turns into a famous New York writer. people like Alexander Gumberg, who was, again, an immigrant from the Russian Empire, who was very active, actually since 1917, in assisting and trying to create more friendly relations, he becomes a New York friend, right? So a lot of the people are there, but they're there in ways that kind of highlight this idea of a clear gap or gulf or even abyss between the land of the capitalists and the world of socialism, because all of these people who cross that border in various ways, culturally or linguistically or through emigration, all of that is elided. The only immigrants that really show up are the ones who are dissatisfied with their lot in the United States, right? The ones who can demonstrate that things are better in the Soviet Union. But the ones who have made good in the United States, they don't show up.
Right.
This is interesting editing decisions.
Yeah. So it's not right. So it's not like they, and of course, like the family in Hartford, that episode is completely cut. The idea, the story about they eventually earn $600 selling a treatment for a screenplay in Hollywood, that is not a part of their story. And it's interesting because Pilniak in his American travelogue has a whole section about how awful it was working in Hollywood. And so he includes it. They worked really hard, but I think they had a very different experience than Pilniak. It was not a negative experience, I think, for them. So they just leave it out. Right. And we're just not going to talk about that. So they wanted to excise the people who kind of blurred the lines in many cases.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting aspect of that written material. Now, I'm interested in the other side of this recording of the trip. Ilf took many, many photographs during this trip. Tell us about the importance of photography in documenting this trip, but also how do they, where do they appear? Some of that is, were they meant to be included with the text? Were they meant to be separate? Tell us a little bit about that history.
The photographs, I think, were a really important part of the project. And my sense is, and this is really more based on Erica Wolf's work than my own research, but that One Story America, the book, when it was published, was also supposed to have photographs, but it's not entirely clear why they were left out. It may have been because Rodchenko kind of totally pans them. It may have been because just cost factors, yeah. Right? It's like too expensive to include them. It also may be because there's a certain kind of modernist sensibility about the sort of photo essay that maybe they wanted to not bring into the travelogue. But even without the pictures, the influence of having had the camera, I think, is definitely there in the written text. I give an example of how they describe the New York skyline almost as if they're filming it more than a kind of static postcard view of the New York skyline. But Ilf was very interested in taking pictures, and the pictures are not, like, they're not great. I reproduce in the book a few pages out of this photo essay, so you can kind of get a sense of what he's doing. And this is what Rodchenko is really responding to, is that they're kind of amateurish pictures. They're not very interesting. They don't, from his point of view, have like a special point of view. And I think in some ways that's the whole point of them, that they're kind of there as more observations. They invite viewers to kind of look at America and see it without kind of telling them how to see it. Of course, the captions offer some suggestions there, but the pictures themselves are kind of deadpan, and they are of everything from a somewhat, you know, banal view of the Grand Canyon from the rim, which just, you know, doesn't translate into the format very well. But they're also interested in pictures of road signs and advertisements. There's a fair number of portraits of different people in it, which are really interesting. Tons of pictures of the road. Lots of pictures of gas stations. Like, really a lot of gas stations published. Which is, and so those kinds of things, you know, are really giving viewers a chance, you know, just look at what's here, right? They're very kind of observational, very flat kind of pictures that obviously they play with the captions in interesting ways. But if you just look at the pictures, and this is what Rodchenko hated about them, is that there's nothing artistic about them. There's no kind of irony in them. There's no point of view. They're just these sort of, he calls them bookkeeping.
I mean, the very concept of one story, right, is also in a way translated into images, which is something that Rodchenko would have hated with his kind of different, you know, extreme viewpoints and perspectives in photos. You can imagine where he would.
Everything is very flat, right? There's no, right. So he has no patience with it, but it's sort of strange to me, because his advice is you should caption these photos. And it's like, well, they did caption the photos, right? Like, look at, this thing was published in part before he wrote his criticism, and there are captions. So I don't know why he didn't pay attention to them.
Yeah, interesting. And in your book, you know, just how much Ilf enjoyed taking photographs, that Petro said that he lost his colleague to photographs, just the extent of the amount of time that he spent doing that. So it's really interesting how they work with the text in that regard.
Yeah, and it seems like he, you know, he took a ton of photographs. So he that to him was something that he was very, very interested in. And it then became kind of a part of the project, and it makes sense for a travelogue, right, to show as well as to tell what they saw.
So do you think they had a great time in the US overall?
Well, you know, I think they enjoyed some things. I think they, by the time they left, I think they were more than ready to go. They described themselves as filled to the brim with America. And I think they were ready to go by the end. Part of that was they were incredibly homesick. They left, must have been in like September of 1935. They get to the US in early October 1935, and they don't get back home until late January, February 36. They both have little kids at home. They miss their wives, they miss their kids. They're incredibly homesick. This comes out in all of their letters. They don't say anything about it in the published account, but they're always talking about how their guides are missing their child. They have a two-year-old back in New York.
Home, right.
A two-year-old that they left in New York, and that the guide said, we can give you 2 months and not a day longer because we need to get home to our daughter. So they project all of that missing the kid onto the guide, but it's clear that they're feeling that. The other piece of it is that Ilf is very sick by the time the trip ends. He had been ill with tuberculosis for a long time. He apparently flares up somewhere in the desert southwest. And then by the time they get to New Orleans on the way home, he's coughing up blood. He's very, very sick. So this is why they actually have this opportunity to take a free cruise on a United Fruit vessel to like Jamaica and Panama. And they pass on that and they get back this head directly back essentially. And they get back in like late January, early February 36. And then they publish, you know, this serialized photo essay, and then the book comes out in 1937, really almost just like right at the almost the exact same moment that Ilf dies in 1937. And then the US translation comes out shortly after that. So sorry, I kind of lost my train of thought there.
No, it is. Yeah. I mean, it is a wonderful, it looks, they had a terrific time, but of course, there is that pull and a lot of other things. Yeah.
So I don't think I think they enjoyed a lot of people that they met. They come back and they write Stalin a letter,
yes,
which is like kind of crazy when you read this. And a big piece of this letter is you need to send like local party members to the United States so they can see what the Soviet Union could be. Like you can't even believe what's possible until you actually go. So this seems like, of course they're not going to do this because there's no way that they're catching up with those kinds of things. But that's the letter that they write. So on the one hand, they want all of the kind of, you know, good roads, good service, cleanliness, efficiency, democracy in the sense of you can knock on the president's door kind of thing.
Does that actually embolden them to write to Stalin?
I don't know why they write to Stalin, and they write on one other issue too, but it seems insane to me that they write this letter to Stalin, but they do. So in some ways they love things that they saw in the US, but by the time they get to California, they're really ready to come home. And there's a lot that they can't stand. This sort of vulgarity of American culture. They really just can't stand. There's a very churlish section where they kind of make fun of these college students at University of California, Berkeley, which, full disclosure, I went to University of California, Berkeley, so maybe I'm taking this a little hard. But they meet with Alexander Kahn, who teaches Russian language and literature there, and he introduces them to his students who are studying Russian. And they kind of make fun of these sort of vacuous American college students. And it's like, well, they are learning Russian. Your English by your own account is unremarkable. These young people learning Russian, you know, don't make fun of them. But sort of the whole American college experience and the idea of like Cal Bears and all of this, they just think is absolutely stupid and complete sort of American, you know, anti-intellectualism. And they can't stand it.
Oh, that's right. It's really interesting what catches their eye in some of these descriptions that you describe for the reader. Liz, thank you so much for talking to us today
Of
about this
course.
amazing book. Liz and I had smile throughout the entire conversation. This is just the book is terrific. It's funny. It's wonderful. It's just a very different insight into this moment in time and the cultural and diplomatic relations between Soviet Union and the United States. And yeah, as I said, really funny, which is what you would expect. But yeah, it does come through the Lisa's material and description of these encounters. Lisa, what comes next?
I'm working on a couple of collaborative projects at the moment. So I'm doing a second edition with my co-authors Troy Chatterjee and Debbie Field of our textbook Russia's Long 20th Century. So that I think is going to be very exciting, and we're hoping to get that done. And I'm also working as a co-editor with Melissa Feinberg on a Routledge Handbook of World Communism. So those are the kind of two
small
big
topics,
projects. That I, so at some point, I mean, I got interested, as I said, in retracing this road trip, partly because I was interested in the connections between immigrants from the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union. So maybe I'll find, you know, some other way to explore those connections, but that's just sort of a notion at the moment. Yeah. Nothing specific that I'm working on.
I can only imagine different things that open up during tracing of this road trip.
There were so many threads to follow that it's, you know, it's only a small portion of them actually end up in the book.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, thank you again for being a guest at New Books Network, and we hope we'll have you back before too long.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Take care.